NHS Live Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, a UK charity that I set up 15 years ago to help people with cancer find out about and use integrative medicine to help them regain their health and well-being. I've been honoured to have several very distinguished guests from the USA on the show in recent weeks, and this is the case again today. Dr. Linda Isaacs has worked alongside Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez and, since his untimely death, has shouldered the responsibility for taking forward the important work of the unique treatment protocol that has been developed over many decades. This protocol has made its mark internationally for the results that have been achieved in tackling some of the most aggressive and classically untreatable cancers. I'm speaking to Dr. Isaacs in Austin, Texas. Hello, Dr. Isaacs. Thank you very much for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to it.
Great. So you're in the hugely important position of having taken over from Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez following his untimely death in 2015. And by the way, I just can't believe it was almost 5 years ago. But given what happened, it was more than fortunate that you were up to speed with his work and it didn't get lost. Opinions vary widely as to Dr. Gonzalez's contribution to cancer care. How important would you say it was?
Well, I think that the work that Dr. Gonzalez and I have been doing is keeping alive something that I think has enormous promise and has never truly been properly investigated by the orthodox medical world. So I believe that that he felt he was on a mission, as I feel I'm on a mission, to continue to keep that work alive and to treat patients and to write case reports and to do what we can to preserve this so that hopefully someday it can be added to the orthodox armamentarium or even replacement.
Right. So Dr. Gonzalez became quite a familiar, if controversial, figure in the US cancer scene towards the end of his life, but I'd say he was generally a lot less well-known here in the UK. I personally was completely gutted to miss the opportunity to meet him and hear him speak when he visited London not long before he died. I heard about his visit too late, and I wasn't able to go. I was really fed up about that. But I was going to say, for our UK audience, I wonder if you'd mind giving probably the short version of the story that starts with Beard's researches, goes through Dr. Kelly to Dr. Gonzalez to you.
Well, sure. Dr. Gonzalez had actually gotten in this line of work because he investigated the work of a man named Dr. William Donald Kelly, who had been using enzymes to treat pancreatic enzymes specifically to treat cancer patients throughout the 1960s, 1970s, and into the early 1980s. But the use of pancreatic enzymes with cancer actually does stem from the work of Dr. Beard, who was a British embryologist who looked at a tissue in early development called the trophoblast, the early stage of the placenta, and noticed that it looked and acted a lot like cancer. And he realized that there's one critical difference, that the trophoblast, the early stage of the placenta, at a certain point matures and stops invading, whereas cancer just keeps going. And he speculated that pancreatic enzymes were the signal, that they were made in the baby at a very early stage of development, and that they might be the signal that stops the trophoblast from continuing to invade. And he felt that that might mean that they could work against cancer.
Hmm. Okay, so this is, if you like, the heart of the treatment that Dr. Gonzalez built up and Dr. Kelly before him. Obviously, there's a lot more to it than just that, but in a way, this is the maybe the least understood or the least acknowledged part about it all. I mean, there's a lot of supplements involved in the protocol, but many people understand how they could influence the situation. But this understanding of how these pancreatic enzymes could affect cancer is not something I think that's that widely appreciated.
Well, it's not, but interestingly enough, it should be, because there's been a lot more research done even in the last 10 or 15 years that supports this general idea.
Okay.
I felt like beard being from Great Britain might be of interest to your audience for that reason, but there's been a lot of information in the last 15 or 20 years that actually supports much of what he said. For instance, he had noticed the similarity of the trophoblasts, that early stage of embryonic development of the placenta, that it looks and acts a lot like a cancer, and that's pretty commonly agreed at this point. They actually use a lot of the same mechanisms on a molecular level to do their job. The idea that the embryo, the baby, makes enzymes at a very early stage in development has also been shown with modern medicine. And then it turns out that there are receptors on the cells of cancer cells, on the surface of the cancer cells that actually interact with pancreatic enzymes.
Mm.
So there's a lot of evidence coming along that indicates that Dr. Beard may well have been on the right track and figured stuff out 100 years before the rest of the medical world.
All right. It's pretty amazing just how far ahead he was with that piece of thinking, isn't it?
Yes, and the other speculation that he had was that we all have cells that are like trophoblast cells that are scattered throughout our body to have the purpose of creating new cells as the need arises. In effect, what he was describing was stem cells.
Right.
And the concept that cancer arises from stem cells is very commonly accepted now, but that was something that he said back then, and people thought he was crazy.
Right. The word stem cell didn't even exist then, presumably.
That's right, yeah. So he was a pioneer in a lot of different ways.
Interesting. So I wonder if you could go into a bit more of the detail of the ways in which, I mean, this is a bit of a jump for people in their thinking, how a placenta could be like a cancer. What are the things that they actually share in common?
The embryo, when it's formed, when the egg and the sperm come together, it's actually just floating freely in space, so to speak. It has to be connected to the mother's body at some point. And it's the trophoblast that performs that function. As the embryo enters into the mother's uterus, the trophoblast's job is to latch on to the uterine wall, to invade, to anchor the embryo, and to create a new blood supply. So it invades and it creates a blood supply. Well, cancer does exactly the same thing. It invades neighboring tissue and it creates a blood supply. So that's the ways that the trophoblast and the cancer are similar in their behavior. And they look very similar under the microscope in many ways as well. But what changes is that at a certain point, the trophoblast matures. It stops invading and turns into the mature placenta, which at delivery will just neatly peel off from the inside of the uterus after the baby is delivered. So the trophoblast changes its behavior, its cancer-like behavior, and becomes mature. The cancer just keeps going.
Right.
What Beard realized when he saw that was that whatever that signal was to get the trophoblast to change its behavior might have a function for the control of cancer. And that's what led him to look at a lot of different things that were going on in both the mother and the baby. What he noticed was that there was evidence under the microscope that the pancreas had started making and secreting pancreatic enzymes. Your typical doctor would say that those enzymes are only used to digest food.
Hmm.
That baby's not going to see a meal for 7 months. And yet, very early on, they're making pancreatic enzymes.
Interesting.
And that's what led him to believe they could have a role with cancer.
That's very interesting, isn't it? You're right. It's like, why on earth would those start up at that point when they're just simply not needed for digestion? How interesting.
Exactly. And usually nature is conservative, the lungs are not ready to go until quite close to delivery.
Mm.
But here the baby is making enzymes with no meal in sight.
Right.
Why?
Right.
And if it's controlling the behavior of the trophoblast, it makes all kinds of sense.
Mm. It does. So you've kind of pointed to a way in which Beard there intuited that maybe this he could come up with a mechanism for controlling cancer based on what he was seeing with the placenta. Does it throw any light on the reasons that cancer starts?
Yes, potentially, because what Beard speculated is that we may not, as individuals, we may not make enough pancreatic enzymes to do the job of cancer surveillance. And that can come about for a lot of different reasons, perhaps an intrinsic weakness in the body, or perhaps a poor diet, which would mean that more enzymes would be needed just for the job of digestion, which is always going to come first. Right. So if you're not making enough enzymes to digest your food, well, then they're not going to be available for cancer surveillance either. Mm. And then also, of course, if you're in an environment that's turning more of the stem cells into malignant cells, well, you can simply overwhelm the job of the enzymes that the body is making. So it comes back around in all those circumstances to not having enough pancreatic enzymes to meet the need that the body is making on its own.
Interesting. So what you're saying then is that the pancreatic enzymes don't just do a job, at the beginning of life in stopping the placenta from being a killer, but actually they carry on through our life doing the same job for the baby once they're born.
Right. That pancreatic enzymes, I mean, once we're out of the womb and eating, they're going to be secreted to digest our food. But they're also part of the surveillance mechanism looking for abnormal cells, pre-cancer cells, and getting rid of them before they can cause trouble. Huh. The theory being that we're all making cancer cells all the time, it's a question of how quickly do we get rid of them again.
Right. So hence the complete logic of supplementation for people who may be low on them or, simply have had a very poor diet, as you say. And so the entire attention of their enzymes has been on trying to cope with what they're eating.
Right. And certainly improving the quality of what they're eating is valuable, but taking some enzymes to help with digestion is valuable as well. If you think about it, it seems like there's an epidemic of people having low-grade digestive issues all the time.
Yes.
People complain of all sorts of digestive issues. And my practical experience is that taking a few pancreatic enzymes can help tremendously with a lot of those different circumstances.
Mm-hmm. But is it widely accepted that it could be a good thing to do for people with cancer, not just to improve their gut function and absorption and things like that, but directly because of the anti-cancer or the cancer surveillance nature of the enzymes?
Widely accepted? No. There are basic science studies that support the topic, and I think that the orthodox world may well figure it out in another 5 or 10 years. But you have to bear in mind that there's not a whole lot of financial support in the regular medical world for doing this research in the first place. Most research is funded by pharmaceutical companies, and there's no money to be made in the treatment of cancer with pancreatic enzymes because it's been done on and off by various people for 100 years. Hmm. So there are some researchers in Israel and in Spain that have done some very interesting work, but whether that's going to take off into common acceptance anytime soon is really hard to say. I do feel like the concepts that we offer get a lot more respect than they did back in Dr. Kelly's era, poor guy.
Yes.
Because back in Kelly's era, even the concept that the trophoblast cells and the cancer cells are similar wasn't getting a whole lot of traction. But at this point, it's actually, I've seen some articles that make that statement and really don't even bother to reference it. It's
okay.
Just commonly known.
Right. Well, that's heartening. But nonetheless, I think it would be fair to say that if you take the line that I asked about earlier, starting with Beard and running through Kelly, Gonzalez to you, that's where the flag's been flying for this approach most vigorously, is it not?
Yeah, that's correct. And Dr. Kelly had actually almost serendipitously found that pancreatic enzymes were having a positive effect on his own condition. He had what was almost certainly pancreatic cancer in the early 1960s. That was before CAT scans or needle biopsies, so he never had a biopsy because they would have had to take him to the operating room to get it. But he had lost 50 pounds and had a tumor sticking out of his abdomen, so it was felt by his doctors to be pretty clear that he had something bad going on. He started taking pancreatic enzymes because his digestion was terrible, but then he noticed a change in the character of the tumor and started to take very high doses, and he got well. So then he went to the medical library and discovered Dr. Beard's work.
So that was there was actually a big gap in a way between, it wasn't a direct handover from Beard to Kelly by any means. It was just the fact that Kelly fortuitously arrived with this conclusion that maybe there was a connection between the state of his cancer and the fact he was taking these enzymes. And then he sort of went back to have a look and see whether anybody else confirmed this.
That's my understanding, yes. I mean, I got that story from Dr. Gonzalez, who got it from Dr. Kelly. There were some other practitioners over the years that had tried to implement Dr. Beard's work, but the overall medical climate just wasn't terribly supportive. The other problem was that, in Beard's era and subsequently, people were using injectable enzymes, which seems like a good idea, but the reality was that the quality could vary quite a lot. Pancreatic enzymes, when they're put in a liquid environment that you would need for injection, are unstable. They will chew each other up, so to speak.
Right.
And so there was a lot of variation in how good the quality of the enzymes were. That was part of the reason why Beard had so much trouble getting his work accepted when he was alive, because there were some doctors that would get fabulous results and others that would get no results. His comment was, well, the enzymes aren't any good when it doesn't work. But that all seemed very complicated. And in the meantime, radiation came along right around the same time and was believed to be, the magic, non-toxic, universally effective bullet.
Yeah.
It didn't work out that way, of course.
Of course.
In the meantime, Dr. Beard had passed away.
Yeah. Well, really interesting. And tell me about the way that enzymes are delivered now.
Well, Dr. Kelly had found that swallowing enzymes, he was initially taking them to work on his digestion, and then he found that swallowing large amounts of them affected his cancer. And so injectable enzymes have not been available in the United States since the 1960s. Dr. Kelly and then Dr. Gonzalez and I have always used oral enzymes, so swallowing them in effect.
Okay, so as I said, I think that's kind of the heart of your protocol there, is this the enzymes and the concept around them. But it's quite a broad protocol and includes a lot of other things. Do you want to tell me about what else goes alongside that?
Well, we also recommend a dietary modification, and this can vary depending on what type of cancer a person has, or there's other conditions that we treat as well. So it would depend on what the general makeup of the patient. So there are some people that I tell to eat an almost completely vegetarian diet, and other people that I will tell to eat a lot of red meat and everything in between. And then there's also detoxification procedures. That is a very important part of it, because when the enzymes do their work, they create waste materials that can make people feel sick if they're allowed to build up. So it's three components, supplements with a lot of pancreatic enzymes, diet, and detoxification.
Okay, so can we just talk about the diet first? Because you told us already there that you give wildly different diets to different people. How do you know what to give to each patient?
When it comes to cancer patients, they tend, in our experience and also in Cali's, to fall into two categories. The people with what are called carcinomas, that would be your typical like breast cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic, prostate, lung, all of those are carcinomas. And those patients tend to do best with a diet that does not include red meat and rarely includes chicken, but more typically vegetables, fruits, nuts, seeds, eggs, dairy, fish. So that group of patients would fall into that dietary category. The other group of patients with immune type cancers like leukemia or lymphoma, they tend to do better with a more carnivorous diet, quite a lot of red meat and fat in the diet. They're the folks that don't do well with a lot of carbohydrates, and they need fat and protein. So they would fall into the other category.
I see. All right, interesting. So the choice of diet is actually based on their diagnosis, not on their physical makeup.
Well, their diagnosis is based on their physical makeup.
True. Okay.
In other words, there are some people that if they're going to get cancer, it will be a carcinoma, and there are other people that if they're going to get cancer, it will be an immune disorder. So it really relates more to the person with the diagnosis, so to speak. It's just the diagnosis is kind of a handy marker for knowing which approach to give.
All right.
This all ties into autonomic physiology, and I can certainly go into that if you think your audience is would like me to go into that in depth. I guess it starts to get a little technical, and I wasn't sure if we wanted to go there or not.
Well, look, let's have a little dig, because actually an awful lot of my audience are what I'd call experts on themselves, and they know a lot, and they're interested to hear some expert comments.
Okay. Well, the idea behind the differing diets that we give people has to do with the function of what's called the autonomic nervous system. And that is the nervous system that controls functions that we don't have to consciously think about, like our heartbeat or our blood pressure or our digestion. And the autonomic nervous system has two parts. The sympathetic nervous system is in charge of the fight or flight response. It helps us get out of the way if we're about to get hit by a car. And so when the sympathetic system fires, it raises the heart rate and the blood pressure so we can move fast and think fast and, get lots of blood to our muscles and to our brain. But it will tend to shut down the digestion, because if we're about to get hit by a car, digesting our lunch really isn't all that important. And so when the sympathetic system fires, it tends to shut down the whole digestive tract, including the pancreas. The parasympathetic system is in charge of the rest and digest function, so to speak. It's what fires when we're resting and repairing. It stimulates the immune system, which sounds like a good thing. And it stimulates digestion, but it will tend to slow down the heartbeat and drop the blood pressure. So the two systems work in opposition to one another, and ideally they would both be working in a balanced kind of way.
Right.
What happens in illness of any kind is that one of those systems is on more of the time than the other one is, and so you come up with different types of imbalances. When the sympathetic system is overactive, the body is constantly in a fight or flight mode. It tends to make the cells more acid in our experience. And it also shuts down the digestive tract, including the pancreas. So those patients typically do better with a diet with vegetables and carbohydrates, because their digestive system is just not that strong. And so Right. they need things that can be digested comparatively easily, like carbohydrates. They also need their salads for the roughage and their fruits, and they do well with fruit. And when they get cancer, it's more likely to be the carcinoma type family. Mm-hmm. So that's where the dietary recommendations for those people come in. The people with the overactive parasympathetic system, where the parasympathetic system is on too strongly and it's pushing the immune system to be on too strongly, that can cause autoimmune disorders, for example, but it also can cause cancers of the immune system, because what's happened over the years is that the immune system was overstimulated and eventually becomes, one part of it anyway, can become unregulated. Hence the immune cancer. Those people, though, because their digestion tends to be quite rapid, if you give them carbohydrates, they have a lot of ups and downs in their energy levels, just because it's like throwing kindling on a fire.
Yes.
These sticks, you're just going to go poof and then nothing, poof mm-hmm. and then nothing as you put kindling on.
Right.
What those people need is something that burns for a long time, like a log, protein and fat.
Right. Well, look, that's really interesting. I don't think I've delved into that myself. So you've directly related there. I mean, a lot of people talk about the relationships between stress and cancer, for example, but they don't necessarily specify that it's likely to be stress and a carcinoma.
Well, that's true, but at the same time, most studies are done with, you know, typical cancer patients, and the vast majority of patients with cancer actually have carcinomas.
Yes.
So Dr. Kelly would have predicted that that patients with leukemia and lymphoma, for example, would be better off with the visualization of, you know, war games and attacking the cancer, you know, that kind of visualization.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas the patient with the carcinomas with the overactive sympathetic system will typically do better with meditation and something that's more calming.
Yeah, very interesting. And I liked your analogy there of the fire. You can sort of see that if you have a machine, if you like, that's running really fast, gobbling up fuel, that actually to give it something to get its teeth into and go, it will steady it and bring it more under control. I can sort of see that. And the whole drive, if you're conscious of the fact that you've got a sort of overactivity in the immune system, you can see how a whole range of different approaches would be things that, as you say, would be calming to that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for going into that a bit. That was really interesting. During the time that you've been doing this work, has the protocol remained largely the same, or have there been important developments?
Well, I've actually been working with Dr. Gonzalez all along. I know the perception can be that I, you know, took over the work when he passed away. But in fact, he and I have been working together in one capacity or another since the mid-80s.
Wow.
You know, in terms of has the protocol not been modified, I would say the basic guts of it are really the same as what Dr. Kelly used. There have been some things that have been added over the years. Like, for instance, we didn't use, you know, alpha-lipoic acid or N-acetylcysteine in 1992, but, you know, the idea of pancreatic enzymes, of diet modifications, of detox, all of that has stayed the same over the years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, one of the things that's kind of legendary about the protocol is the Olympic number of capsules involved. Do you want to say something about why there are so many different supplements involved in the protocol and a bit about how people can deal with incorporating this into their lives?
Well, the pancreas product that we recommend people take, there's only so much you can fit into a capsule. And in order to get the necessary dosing down, they need to take in the territory of 100 of those a day, give or take. They're taken away from meals and they're in multiple doses. You don't swallow them all at once.
Mm.
But that's one group of pills. And then the rest of the pills, we use a lot of glandular extracts. So things like freeze-dried and ground up and encapsulated liver or thymus and different organs that we feel help give those areas a specific thing they need to repair. So that's one group of supplements. Then there are things like multi-minerals, multivitamins, and also individual capsules of things like calcium and magnesium or potassium. part of the reason why there's a lot of little pills, so to speak, with what we do is because it makes it possible for us to fine tune. So for instance, I might have two patients with breast cancer, but one of them's on more magnesium than the other. And in order to make that practical and possible, we need to have small components rather than just one big multivitamin and that's it.
Yes.
So that accounts for quite a lot of the pills. And I will say that this is not a protocol for somebody that simply can't swallow capsules. It's just the way it is. You know, we have to deliver it in some format, and capsules is what we use. Beyond that, most of the patients do get quite good at swallowing pills,
right.
And we recommend that they make up little bags of things so that they can carry around with them and incorporate it into their life. I'll also say that smartphones have helped a lot because patients can program reminders,
right.
You know, as opposed to having to keep it in their mind.
Mm-hmm. So it's fair to say then that the lion's share of the pills are actually the enzymes, is that true?
The lion's share are the enzymes, yes. And what we use actually is the freeze-dried pancreas product. So it by nature contains a lot of enzymes, both in the active and inactive form. So that's what we use.
Mm. Okay. Can we just talk a little bit about the detox side of things? Well, first of all, why is it an important part of the protocol? I mean, I can imagine, but I'd love to hear what you have to say about it. And exactly what do you do to achieve it?
The detoxification end of the protocol is very important because it helps the patients get rid of waste materials that, if they were allowed to build up in the system, could make them feel sick. Dr. Kelly, in the course of devising his own self-treatment, learned this the hard way because he had modified his diet. He was taking pancreatic enzymes. Things seemed to be going well, and then he started to get sick, you know, with nausea and body aches and flu-like symptoms.
Mm.
And it made it difficult for him to take his pancreas. And so he realized he needed to come up with some kind of a solution. What he came up with, what he did, was coffee enemas. Now, coffee enemas are also a part of the Gerson protocol, but in fact, neither Kelly nor Gerson invented coffee enemas. They've been around for a long time before that, and they were commonly used for poisonings. There's quite a number of references that I found in the medical literature from the 1800s and early part of the 1900s that talk about their use in poisoning.
Right.
So it makes sense that Kelly would come up with using them to get rid of what he speculated were tumor wastes that were making him feel sick.
Mm. So he's quite a creative chap, Mr. Kelly. What was his background that enabled him to tackle his own condition in such an innovative way?
Well, he was an orthodontist by training, so he did have a scientific training, in effect, through dental school and his orthodontic training.
Mm.
And then he had gotten interested in nutrition because I think the dental world has in many ways been ahead of the medical world in recognizing the importance of nutrition because they're looking at people's teeth all day long, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if people are eating poorly, their teeth are going to be in bad shape.
Right.
So he developed an interest in nutrition and did a lot of reading even before he himself got sick.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to the protocol as a whole, I think that it's fair to say that it's not so much a cure as a cancer management strategy. So is this characterization accurate? And can you say a bit about the difference between attempting to cure as opposed to control cancer?
Well, the word cure is a little tricky in the medical world. You know, to say cure implies, you know, long period of disease-free survival. And we do have patients that have achieved that. But we also have patients who, in effect, coexist with their disease for a long, long period of time, you know, well after they should have taken their life.
Right.
And in the case reports that we have published in the past, we tend to focus on those with resolution of disease, but we have some others where, like I said, they coexist with it. What I would say, though, is that if cancer is a lifestyle issue and an issue of a shortage of pancreatic enzymes, then, you know, the concept that you can use a program like this and get better and then go back to your old way of life and eat whatever you want and not take the pancreatic enzymes is really just saying you're going to put yourself right back in the position that you were in when you got the cancer in the first place.
Right.
To me, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And we try to encourage people to think of this as a lifestyle change as opposed to a cancer treatment.
Well, that makes complete sense. Yes, if you were addressing something that was fundamentally wrong in the operation of the person's system in the first place, then yes, if its skeletons still always need support in order to work well, then yeah, that's completely logical what you say. Okay, so the legacy that you're carrying forward is a long-lived one from the way we've been talking about it, and it's clearly a very important one. I was wondering, where have you taken it, or where has it taken you in the last 5 years since you've been taking it on your own, and where do you see it going in the next 5 years?
Well, my goal is to, first of all, of course, continue to see patients, which I am doing, and just keeping up the work in that way. I also am continuing to publish case reports, and in fact, I had an article published last year that described, you know, two patients that I've seen in the general window. One of them I saw just before Dr. Gonzalez passed away, and another started with me actually afterwards. There was one of them with metastatic lung cancer, the other with metastatic colon cancer, who had documented regression of disease on the treatment. So my goal is to continue to collect case reports. I also relocated my practice from New York City to Texas.
Yes.
Partly, you know, the reason really we were in New York in the first place was because Dr. Gonzalez was a native New Yorker.
Okay.
But my own feeling was that, you know, New York City has become increasingly, you know, expensive and difficult. And my plan is, you know, at the right time, when the right person comes along, to train someone to carry this work on. To do that, I feel like they need to be working directly with me in my office, and it's just prohibitively expensive to try to manage that in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So I relocated last year, and really I would have to say that the last 5 years, you know, partly is just in regrouping. I mean, losing Dr. Gonzalez was just devastating for me. It was so completely sudden. You know, I had spoken to him earlier that day, and then, you know, the next morning find out that he's gone. And that was extremely devastating, both for me and for his patients, to, you know, to have that happen. So really, you know, the first couple of years were just regrouping and then planning to move. But I feel like things are stable and progressing. And like I said, my goal is to continue to collect and publish case reports. And when the right person or people comes along, to train someone so that this work can continue even after I am no longer working.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned earlier, of course, the climate for treatments which are kind of unorthodox, if you want to use that word, has improved enormously in the last very recent years. I mean, it's changing very rapidly now, I think. And hopefully this is going to make your work there much more easily acceptable to a wider audience of professionals.
Well, I certainly hope so. I think especially for just the impact that it has on the patients to deal with the disapproval of their other physicians.
Yes.
I think that has lessened, but, you know, it's not easy to make the sweeping kind of lifestyle changes in terms of the diet and all the rest. And if you're dealing with active hostility from a medical practitioner, it makes it, you know, hard to keep going. I mean, my patients tend to be very independent and kind of feisty feisty lot,
right,
to have made the choice to pursue something like this. But still, you know, their life would be easier if their doctors would be a little more supportive.
Mm. And also, of course, it would be great if you didn't have to be such an unusual character to step outside of the box in this way. If it was something that was more readily available and more normal, if you like, as a choice, for a much broader range of patients to be looking at.
That would be good as well. I totally agree.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to finish by getting a kind of top-line view of the message of the protocol. In a way, it's a proof of principle that should in itself, if we were in a sane world where cancer's not a for-profit business, it should prompt much more research and investment because of what's been achieved at your centre principally. So what would you say are the key principles about cancer and about dealing with cancer that the protocol demonstrates?
Well, I think that the protocol would demonstrate that pancreatic enzymes have a role in the treatment of cancer. And I think that regardless of what method a person is, however they're choosing to approach their cancer, that taking at least some pancreatic enzymes with the meal is indicated, and that pancreatic enzymes may have a much bigger role than what is commonly accepted now. I think also that this protocol emphasizes the importance of eating a clean diet and one that is without processed foods, so no white flour, no white sugar, for example. And so it's another illustration of how important that that is for really everybody, not just cancer patients.
Right. And the reason really that it is a kind of proof of principle is because of some of the stunning achievements that have been brought about there in terms of typically patients that are classed as incurable that you've really had the biggest successes with. I think, you know, that's what's made your clinic world famous, essentially, isn't it?
Well, we've always had the goal of, you know, publishing the case reports that demonstrate that the method can be effective if it's applied. And, you know, that was what got me interested in this work in the first place. Mm. Dr. Gonzalez was looking through Dr. Kelly's records and finding cases of people that unquestionably should have been dead, and they were still alive, having only worked with Dr. Kelly and done his protocol. Mm. You know, there's one of those women. She was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in 1975, and I actually checked up on her in 2016. She has an unusual last name, and so I decided to see if I could track her down.
Right.
She's still alive as of that time. You know, at that point, she was 82 years old. So she'd had nasty, nasty, nasty breast cancer diagnosed in 1975, and she's still alive like 40 years and more afterwards. So that's the kind of records that I have seen, and that's why I do what I do. Mm. I have my training in internal medicine, but I choose to do this work because I really have to, because I've seen people get well that should have been gone, and those people and their stories keeps me motivated.
Right. Stunning achievement. Okay. Well, look, it's lovely to have had the chance to talk today. Curiously, no sooner had we made contact due to your now cancelled visit to the UK than there you were on Kelly Turner's astoundingly good docuseries, Radical Remission, showcasing one of your extraordinary successes. So in two ways, I feel like I've really got to know you a bit this week. And I look forward to hopefully meeting you as and when the London trip gets reinstated.
Well, I certainly hope to. And in the meantime, if your audience is interested in learning more, they can certainly visit my website.
I will give out the details. That's great. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Isaacs.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Well, Dr. Isaacs' treatment protocol certainly seems to have a very unusual angle to offer to integrative medicine, and the spectacular results demand that it be given due attention so many more people with cancer can reap the benefits. As Dr. Linda mentioned, she has further resources on her website
at www.drlindai.com. So that's all lowercase, drlindai.com. So do take a look. I send you all best wishes, and I hope that you and your family are keeping well while we all sit out the storm of coronavirus, and also that you're not suffering undue hardship due to the restrictions in place. I hope you enjoyed listening today. It's been my pleasure to introduce the work of Dr. Isaacs to you, and I hope you'll be able to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.